music, news, interviews, live events, and more. Welcome to the Hivecast with Matt Pinfield.
It's Matt Pinfield hanging out with James Blake. James, so good to have you here, man.
Thanks for having me.
I was saying, like, I was talking about Zane Lowe. Was like, I love him dearly, and he's a great DJ. Alex Gilbert, who he was Alex's best man in his wedding. He always thought that we were sitting there at La Zona Rosa in Austin. Mm-hmm. And we had this understanding. It was like, you're the American Zane Lowe. I'm the English Matt Pinfield. Mm-hmm. And he thought I said to him, who are you? And I did. And I said, you know, I used to sleep on Marianne Hobbs' couch in Hackney. And he thought, he thought I was just out of my gourd. You know?
Yeah.
So,
she's,
like Marianne,
she's the best. She's, she was amazing supporting me. Really, like, straight in there, you know, like, before almost anyone. She played Measurements, one of my first ever songs that I ever wrote. She played that on Radio 1, you know, as soon as I sent it to her. So she's,
I love her because she supported me through my first divorce.
Oh, wow.
On the phone, like, her and Miles Hunt were, like,
incredible.
You know, going through, like, I was very, very freaked out. And, and they were there for me.
Yeah.
You know, so that's...
She's that kind of person.
Right, yeah, she's wonderful.
Definitely.
James, I love your songs. I mean, I got to ask you, I love you covering Joni Mitchell, Case of You.
Thank you.
Growing up, what did you like, and what was your childhood like? Your first memories of music, what were you listening to?
First memories of music were sitting on the dock of the bay, I remember. That was probably the first song I ever heard. My dad introduced me to loads of blues music, you know, like early sort of guitar blues. And then kind of old soul, I suppose. That was the kind of the first things I was introduced to. So, you know, almost exclusively black music. And if I was a kind of little sort of suburban, you know, kid from Enfield, it didn't really matter. I was just, I don't know, it's just the music I grew up with. You know, it's just the music I was introduced to first because my dad was... It's so into that.
When you have great parents to turn you on to stuff. It's like Florence from, you know, Florence Welch told me about how her dad gave her Love's Forever Changes and a bunch of soul records. And I'm like, awesome.
Yeah.
Great dad.
Yeah, well, I think there's a whole generation of, we're probably the kids of their generation, you know, who were into that kind of music at the time. It's just when soul had really pierced the UK.
Yeah.
And, the UK later kind of tried to sell it back to them.
Yeah. Always America. Always like England.
Absolutely,
out first and then...
No, it's the other way around. America invents it and the people who invent it can't get a gig in their own country and then they go to England and we like shower them with praise.
I will blame you guys for Pop Idol though.
Oh, yeah.
American Idol. Yeah, awful,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we can... I can't personally take that blame, but as a as an Englishman, I suppose I have to.
Yeah. I remember Damon Albarn going... Simon Cowell said, we're bringing it over to America. He goes, wonderful. You know? Mm. So how about you, like, I mean, your use of keyboards and synthesizer, did you also ever listen to some of the early, like, great, like, 80s, 70s synth stuff that came out of your country?
Not really. I didn't grow up with any electronic music in general. I didn't really discover any electronic music until I was about, and that was more dance music. And that was when I was about 15, 16.
What dance was it, like Black Box or like, or, you know, or later stuff? Like
no, it was jungle.
Yeah, jungle stuff?
Yeah, it was jungle music and kind of rave, like hardcore, that kind of thing, drum and bass. I mean, that was...
Like Tricky and, you know, people like that.
Yeah. They were the first...
Ronnie Size, things like that?
Yeah.
Massive Attack, you like that?
Yeah. These were things that I heard and didn't necessarily know, you know, or get into at the time. But I just, that's what I was hearing when I went to clubs. I was hearing jungle and drum and bass and then some dubstep. And then, you know, and then it went from there. And then I wanted to get into it.
Yeah. I mean, it's great how you took your emotional thing with your lyrics right into that. I mean, tell me about Wilhelm Scream and the early EPs. Like, when did you know, like, you were taking your emotional lyrics and what you were doing into that realm? And
I don't think I knew. I think the I think electronic music was a kind of vehicular vocabulary for me. It was and it still is. It's just my palette, part of my palette. I use what's in front of me, you know, and try and make music with it. And I don't think it didn't really occur to me that I was trying to inject electronic music with anything else. I was just
what you had.
Yeah, I was just making music by me. You know,
that's great. Yeah.
But making music by me with the things that were in front of me, and what was in front of me was kind of these sounds that I liked at the time, and I still like, and I'm moving in new ways now. But you know, it's just I'll keep moving on, and I'll make music with what's in front of me. As I said,
lyrically, there's so much like soul relationship reflection in your songs, which I think is great, and overgrown. It's like it's going even further.
Mm.
Tell me about a case of you when you covered Joni Mitchell. I mean, I always wanted to ask you why you found that, because I have a lot of English friends who love Joni, and I always wanted to know how you found it.
Yeah, I listen to Blue every day.
All those songs. Yeah, so great, right?
Yeah, every day for 2 years. I think I listened to it every night, and I wasn't having. I remember I wasn't having a great time at university. I just didn't want to be there, and I used to go to sleep. Just not really wanting to be there, basically. Not happy.
Comfort in the words and like the record itself.
Yeah, and I wasn't definitely not a happy person. And that album got me through a good 2 years of not really wanting to be somewhere. So, and it made me write in this really intense way. I loved it. I absolutely adored that album. It was a friend to me. Yeah. It was a total friend to me. So, when music catches you at that point.
Yeah.
You have a deeper connection with it, and Joni's voice just seemed like the voice of an absolute. It was just an angel,
it really is, right?
Beautiful, pure, just the purest voice, unbelievable. And the lyrics were great, and I just every part of that music, I aspired to. So it was probably the biggest influence on the first record.
What do you think about the fact that, like, she wrote Woodstock, but her manager told her she couldn't go because she had to do the Cavett show, but she wrote the song that, like, embodied it because Graham Nash called her, another Brit from Manchester.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Do you listen to Court and Spark, too? It's a great record. What do you think of those albums? Do you like any of that stuff?
Yeah, I keep to basics with her. Yeah. I do.
Ladies of Canyon.
Yeah, but I do find... And the album before Blue, just before Blue, which I can't remember the name.
Circle Game? I mean, no, that was Tom Rush, but it was her song.
No, it's a white cover.
Yeah, with Clouds?
A picture of her. A painted picture. Anyway, the more minimal side of her is really what I absolutely adore. The more experimental she got, sometimes the more interesting it gets, and I go with it, and I love it.
As a listener, but not like...
But I only discovered her really recently, so I'm still like, you know, and because that Blue was my introduction. So I listened to it for 2 years.
24, 25 hours?
22 I was. 22. So I'm discovering her back catalogue, you know, at a natural pace. And I feel like I'm fascinated by how artists develop over the course of their life, not just in the first few years when they write some hits.
Yeah.
You know, like, or whatever. And I'm not just talking about Joni, but I mean, you know, a lot of people write some of their best work when they're young. But I'm fascinated by people who write their best work when they're 40, 50, you know.
Like something hits them. Like
something, Collins, a maturity, like yeah, like a maturity imbues what they're doing with something else that you'd never have got from them when they were younger or whatever. And... I'm fascinated by how people can develop.
That whole thing that, like, you write your best shit when you're young and, like, when you're angry. It's bullshit, right?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it totally is. Or I think it's a fallacy when the person's subject matter isn't necessarily angry or kind of spurred on just by being youthful. Like, some people's subject matter has got nothing to do with the fact they're young. It's just the fact, you know, if anything, they sound older than their age. And when they do
reach that age
that they sounded like in the first place, then their music becomes quite unbelievable.
Yeah.
I think Laura Marling might be one of those people.
Yeah, oh, she's great.
Well, Laura Marling is great, and I love her voice and I love her songs.
Who else do you love? I mean,
Recently I've been listening to Jeremiah's mixtape, Late Nights, which I love. There's so much good stuff coming from Chicago. There always has been, but I mean, there is. There still is. They're keeping the flame well and truly alive. And not to mention, like, Duke, footwork, music, and stuff like that. But recently I've been listening to things like Chance the Rapper just did a mixtape, which sounds really good.
For singer-songwriters, do you ever go back like Joni and find anybody else like Tom Rush or Jackson Browne or Timmy or any of that stuff?
Who have I been recently most listening to? What do I love? Well, I love Stevie Wonder. I mean,
Inner Visions?
Well, yeah. I have to say my favorite album is Talking Book.
Yeah.
But it might also be Fulfilling This First Finale.
Yeah. That trio.
Yeah.
Is amazing.
Yeah. 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 Is it?
A Golden Lady, you know.
Mm hmm.
Tell you about it.
Everything
on those three records were in. It was like a. It was amazing.
But I know every Stevie Wonder song almost off by heart.
Yeah.
He's the person who I could probably just reel off his entire catalog. Yeah. That's probably the only one.
Have you ever gotten to meet him? Or
I nearly met him. By chance, there was something happening where Kanye West was getting people around to his studio and he wanted me to come and play him some beats and stuff. And I went along and took my laptop and just sort of played him some stuff. Nice guy. You know,
yeah.
He was just very into music and whatever. And he said something about Stevie might be coming along, and I went, sorry, did you just say Stevie? You know, like, are we talking about the same guy?
Yeah.
You know, because to me, I'm just a... Sometimes when I'm in these situations that, you know, it's quite difficult to keep your cool if someone says that Stevie's coming through.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is the person that I've grown up completely idolizing as a musician and as a person, but as a singer mostly.
Yeah.
I
mean, the octaves on Golden Lady, how it raises.
Just...
I sat there with Jason from Jamiroquai one day. We're like backstage in like D.C. and we were just singing that. We were just hanging out. We were having a night and just figuring out how high the octaves were. And then I Never Dreamed You'd Leave Me in Summer.
Yeah.
But really, Talking Book, Inner Visions, Fulfilling His First Finale, those are the...
Honestly, it warms the cockles of my heart.
Yeah.
Just to even think about Stevie Wonder's music, it just breathes life into me to listen to some of his records. It's like, it will never be. I'll always be able to put a record on and go, yeah, well, I know what I'm going to do now. He's the one person who I could listen to his records and go, I know where I'm going now.
Yeah.
From here.
I met him, and it was, for me, great to meet him, but it was also awkward because we didn't have the face-to-face thing. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. Because
of course.
And I went up to meet him. I wanted to just tell him how much I loved, mm-hmm. you know, Inner Visions and mm-hmm. so many songs. Mm-hmm. You know, If You Really Love Me. I mean, there's 100 mm-hmm. songs he's mm-hmm. done that I love so much. But this guy with him tapped him on his leg and said, just kind of gave him this guy's okay. You know, mm-hmm. he's cool. You can
see the rundown and what, yeah.
And I just went, Stevie, I love you. I want to tell you how much I appreciate it. And that was it.
Yeah.
You know, we take for granted sometimes the warmth of the face and the glance.
Yes, totally, yeah.
See, you know what I mean?
Yes, totally. And I'm sure he got a warm presence from you. Yeah, of course.
I was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
This is The Hivecast with Matt Pinfield.
Tell me about working with Brian Eno on the new record. I mean, how did Brian, was he a fan of Wilhelm Scream and...
I think he was actually a fan of the album, funnily enough. I didn't know if he'd heard it until a bit later on. Until when I actually went round and then he said, you know, actually, I really like your music and very interesting. It's one of the things he said, and I thought, God, well, if you think it's interesting, then we're...
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that means something, you know.
What'd your dad and mom say when they heard, you know, like your stuff?
Well, my dad was funny because he was also in, you know, he's in a lot of bands.
Anyone and, I would know ever in England?
Well, he was in a band called Coliseum, who were much bigger.
I remember them.
They were great. They were much bigger in America than they were.
They were actually very prog, kind of like rock.
Yeah. And
remember the Stone kind of cover they had on that record? I love that record.
No, they. I mean,
tell your dad.
That's funny.
Someone remembers it. I like
totally,
it.
Totally. So my dad kind of wasn't a very big fan of Brian Ferry. I remember.
Yeah.
And.
It was either
Roxy
like,
music
was
great.
Roxy and that stuff. Or
he loved Roxy. I think he loved Roxy music.
And that kind of stuff,
I think they might have even supported them.
Really?
And I think he said he loved what Roxy music were doing, but he didn't particularly like what Brian Ferry was doing. And I remember Brian Eno and Brian Ferry kind of had.
Oh, they like fell out.
Yeah, like, they kind of fell out. So
after For Your Pleasure, it was like, we cannot be in the same room.
Yeah. So my dad kind of sides with Eno anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I said I was going around, you know, he was like, you know, you'll have a great time because he's a nice guy, you know. And I didn't know much about him, to be honest. I didn't know all his music. I didn't know a lot about him. I didn't know much of Roxy Music's work either.
Bowie or anything?
Yeah. But I knew that Brian Eno had overseen, produced, overseen, whatever, directed so many great albums.
You too.
Yeah.
Baby, right?
Yeah, and so I had to, you know, I got to say, well, look, it's going to be a really amazing experience just talking to him about anything. Never mind my own music, you know. So it was just easy. It was great. Like, I just went in, went round, and door was open, walked in, said, hi, you know, he was like, come on through, you know, sat down, had a cup of tea, very English procedure. There was no pressure to do anything, write anything, get on with anything. No, like, you know, oh, we got this amount of time, you know, so we got to get something done.
That's none beauty, of that. I think none of that. Always looking for like a spur of creativity, and he just goes, right?
We just hung out for a bit, and it was great. And we talked about music and played records, and I played him some of my new music, and he loved it. And he said, you know, you don't need to change much here because you're going in the right direction. And that was a very justifying force. He's a very calming presence, and he certainly was for that part of my journey in the record.
As opposed to someone who's like trying to force opinions or be, you know.
I've met a lot of people who are not like that, yeah. Who are very, very much the opposite, and people who might want to put you in a position you're not comfortable with to get something out of you, and
yeah, like they think they have to make you uncomfortable to like get that thing,
or that they don't even realize they're making you uncomfortable, or that they might,
or they don't even know your music well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic point with Brian was that he gets the music. He just got it. He probably sees straight through it, you know, in terms of how it's made, and I think that's great because it means that there's no bullshit. The ice is broken, and we can just hang out as friends. That was the point. That's when it became something that I knew. Okay, we can make music now because it's just like hanging out.
Yeah, he's so cool. I mean, he and Giorgio Moroder were both in town for the Red Bull Music Academy, and I couldn't go to the thing. I mean, I was on the list, but I was like so bummed.
Oh, yeah, did Brian do a talk then?
Yeah, he did a talk.
Right,
which was great.
Yeah.
So talking about that, take a fall on me. I love like the feel of the way that song starts. It's almost like there's a rainforest or a storm before the lyrics.
Atmospheric.
Tell me about that track. I love it.
Well, I actually wrote the beat in New York.
Really?
It's the only thing on the whole album that was actually written in New York. Yeah.
What, well, that when you toured for Wilhelm?
Yeah, I wrote it in my hotel room.
What hotel? We're gonna know.
I can't remember. It might have been the Standard. I can't remember.
Probably. Yeah.
I can't remember. Or it was like partly on the bus as well. I mean, that's where I had the idea. I was just mucking around with a kind of an ambient thing. Basically, what is there, but without the sort of kick and the snare.
Yeah. Retrograde is a song I love. Tell me about that, because I have to ask you. I'm sorry.
Retrograde is one of my favorite things I've done. You know, like,
beautiful.
Thank you. It's just one of those songs. Normally, with those songs, I can't remember how they came out. This one, I remember exactly how it happened. I recorded some piano and at the end of just singing the song that I'd started writing, completely unrelated to Retrograde, I started to hum, and that became the, you know, that thing, that arpeggiated thing, or whatever it is. And I looped that, and I never thought I'd use that. I just did it, and I just thought, that's just throwaway sort of humming, whatever.
Like a guide.
Yeah.
It became part of the beauty of it.
Yeah. And then I was chopping it up later on in Logic, and I sort of got to that part, and I went, whoa, there's something there. Made a loop out of that, added a kick and a snare, kick and a clap. That was it. They're the only drums, just all I thought it needed. And I sat there, and then I went, and on the floor I have this Taurus bass pedal. It's kind of like the prog rock guys used to use in the 70s. But it's a very, very big sounding bass pedal and a Moog. And so I got on the floor and I just sort of started pedaling out this bass line.
So cool.
And then that loop was formed, and that's basically the whole loop. And me and my friend were kind of red-eyed, shall we say, one night. sort of just sitting there, just completely, you know, bobbing our head, and we just sat there for 2 hours listening to this loop. It felt so organic and kind of, it's nighttime music, but it just had this groove, and it was like, there just needed nothing else. So then I'd need to justify this with something else. And I felt like there needed to be a song. At that point, it was just humming and some clap, you know, kicking a clap.
But you knew it was something.
I knew it was something, yeah. And then I actually got off the phone, had a pretty not great phone call. It really left me kind of really feeling pretty hurt. And I got off the phone and wrote the song immediately, the whole thing. And then I went and sang it a couple of hours later, but I wrote the thing at about 7 o'clock in the morning, or six or something. It's a really weird time to write. That was it. It all happened in about 2 days, and it was really, you know, quite an experience for me. And I really sang out on that tune, and which I hadn't done in any of the other tunes.
It's beautiful. I love it. To the last, I love too. I mean, I just
thanks.
Tell me about that song before we. I know they're telling us we have
that's
all
right.
Much time.
That's all right. That's not a love song.
I know.
To the last, which is weird because all the rest of that. But that one is, the lyrics are really important to me, but I'm probably not going to go into them. They're just...
Without like going into like personal details.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me, explain at least the feeling of...
The feeling of it is almost regretful. It's kind of like, I'm a sucker for regret and I'm a sucker for time passing and like the it's not being sad. It's just the feeling of being human and how time passing reminds you of that and nostalgia. There's a difference between feeling morose and feeling sad and having and that being in a song and that being the driving emotion. That's an emotion in itself, just the feeling of being human. So that, I think, you know, without being too metaphysical, I think that was, that's the kind of feeling behind that tune.
Hey, James, thanks for coming by. It was great to have you today.
Yeah.
Overgrown is the new album from James Blake on the Hivecast.
This has been the Hivecast with Matt Pinfield. For all things music, news, interviews, live events, and more, go to mtvhive.com.